Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned the following may contain names and voices of deceased persons.
You go and ask your husband what been happen.
You gotta push him. You gotta fight against him. If we don't do it, who else gonna do it?
Who knows where the money is going and if they're fighting the right fight? I don't think so. It's just greed and money. It's just money and greed. That's all I know.
We were staying at the Hilton in Chicago, and we were in the room and I couldn't sleep, and it just felt like the walls were just crushing us.
Nigina woman Anne Polina and her partner were in America to attend a book fair when they suddenly felt under spiritual attack.
And so I said, oh, well, when we get up in the morning when we can, we will go and see if we can find a Native American person, because in our culture, when some of these evil things come our way, some of the elders do a smoking ceremony and we can push things back.
This is episode 5 of Wrong Skin. Evil. It's a powerful concept in the Kimberley. And there's a growing feeling in Luma that evil was at the heart of what happened to Richard and Julie. Last episode, we heard Richard's mother, Annie Milgan, is married to John Watson, a man many believe could potentially help solve the mystery of what happened to her missing son. Since the last episode, consciences are being pricked, and Annie Milgan's friends and family are rallying around her as they strive for justice. The Toyota troop carrier, police have been told, may be connected to Richard and Julie's disappearance, belonged to the current Kimberley Land Council chairman, Anthony Watson. He's the son of John. Police have been told that the Watson father and son duo might be able to help shed some light on what happened to Richard and Julie back in 1994. This is because of their status as leaders and their ties to some senior old men who had taken a dim view of Richard and Julie's relationship. We also uncovered seriously violent attacks carried out by John and Anthony Watson, and learned how the justice system treated them very kindly after the Land Council went into bat for them. Since revealing those outcomes, I've heard from several people across the Kimberley who are amazed that their sons and brothers are currently locked up for far less serious crimes, such as stealing a car or some money. Anthony's victim, who was pulled out of his bed and hit on the head with an iron picket repeatedly, has not been able to work again and is on a disability pension. It's fair to say this podcast has got people wondering if all men are truly equal in the eyes of the law. But let's move on to this episode. It's about two extremes. The spiritual side of the Kimberley, where magic, good and evil, is ever present. And the money side, where the haves and have-nots appear to be getting further apart.
So we got up early in the morning and we went down, we got in the taxi, and the guy said to us, taxi driver said, where would you like to go? And we said, we need to find an American, Native American building and center, because we need to see some people because we need some help. And he said, no worries. And we drove and drove and drove and drove. Nearly $100 later, as we were coming towards this building, I could see from a little distance there was a man standing on the steps, and he had his hands folded and almost like he was waiting for us to come. And the taxi pulled up and opened the door, and we went up to him. He says, can I help you? We said, oh, we hope you can. He says, oh, well, come inside and tell me what your story is. So we went into a little room, and I said to him, oh, you know, like, we're Aboriginal people from Australia and something very unusual is happening, and we're staying at the Hilton Hotel, and we've come here to do this thing, and we need to, you know, be strong and ready to go to this, but somehow we feel like something's trying to attack us, come into us, crush our spirit, crush our ability to be strong in this story.
The Native American man took Anne and her partner through a smoking ceremony and then hit them with a question.
Do you realise you have the power? I was sort of thinking, well, this is, doesn't seem to be going where we thought it was going to go. Do you realise you have the power? And I paused and he said, he looked at us again, he says, you are a human being. And it was a bit of an epitome, because basically what he's saying to us is that as a human being, we are a distinct, unique creature. We are human being, and we do have power, and we have within us a way to build a strength to allow us to do the things we need to do, particularly when we have to deal with things that are evil, are from darkness, and particularly human beings who are filled with darkness, who want to destroy other people who come from good energy, from light.
Spiritual belief, whether traditional or Christian, is strong in the Kimberley. For many, there's genuine fear of someone using traditional magic against you or your family for evil. We'll explore that some more next time. I think the fear of spiritual reprisal is one of the reasons people in Luma felt uncomfortable talking about Richard and Julie for so long. I got to know Anne Paulina by chance. At our first meeting in Melbourne, Anne tells me she already knew a fair bit about me. It turns out that Anne knew the late Phoebe Hansjuk, who was the subject of our 2016 podcast, Phoebe's Fall. One of Phoebe's closest relatives used to date someone from Anne's family. Anne considered Phoebe as part of her mob. Anne says if I clear my head and go to a quiet space, I may find Richard and Julie reaching out to me to help tell their story. She says the forces that make this connection possible reside in the land.
The country is alive, it has power, it has beauty. It creates a bit of magic, a sparkle, that just lights your life up and you become part of that lived experience for whatever reason brought you to the Kimberley.
But Anne's not blind to the harsh realities of life in this part of Australia.
We have the highest suicide rate in the world. Higher than all of the other First Nations country, even higher than New Zealand, right here in the Kimberley. We have huge homicide rates for women in particular in the Kimberley. So there's a lot of extreme violence, a lot of intergenerational trauma, a lot of despair, huge poverty.
This episode, we're taking a detour from Luma and the mystery of Richard and Julie. But we'll be coming back to it in a big way next time. First, let's take the temperature of the Kimberley at the moment. Things are getting hot. That's audio from one of many heated meetings in outback Western Australia. These meetings are where decisions are made about which families will get their name on a native title claim. Discontent with those in power and control is rising because of a widespread belief that the same people keep winning while others are left behind. As I drove around the Kimberley to find out more about Richard and Julie, I kept hearing from people feeling let down by the promise of native title and uncertain about their land council. Central to their worries is the corporate structure the KLC's established to represent traditional owners. It's effectively outsourced the profitable parts of native title to entities led by its former chief executive. Some say this arrangement involves real or perceived conflicts of interest. We'll go into that soon. As I went around communities trying to understand why the KLC is on the nose with so many, I met some interesting characters.
From a very young age, camping and hunting, and by doing camping and hunting, we are learning what's in the country.
That's Richard Hunter. He's a senior law boss from Saltwater Country, just up the coast from Broome. We're resting in the shade of a simple mud brick house nestled in bushland, overlooking the pristine coastline that leads to a place called Walmerdan, or James Price Point in English. Richard's sitting with his close friend, Franz Hoogland.
Yeah, I got a whole different story. Naturally, I was born in the Netherlands, grew up in Amsterdam, and migrated to Australia in 1968 after being working for the Dutch Telegraph, which is like the Australian, in advertising.
This place is about as far away from a European city as you can get.
I didn't like the city life.
James Price Point is where the former WA government, led by Colin Barnett, resources giant Woodside, and eventually the Kimberley Land Council, all wanted to build the biggest gas plant in the Southern Hemisphere. Over a cup of rainwater mixed with elderberry, I listened to Richard and Franz talk about life and the power of their country.
But I never see something like this. And the feeling was something else. Yeah, you're off the planet. On planet Earth, the real planet Earth, right? So I'll keep them working till sundown, and then I saw what I'm going to do, you know.
Franz has a white beard and piercing blue eyes.
So I climbed over the dunes, and I made myself a camp, and I stayed there for 8 months.
He's telling me about the experience on a beach near Broome, which led him to cross over from white man's world about 40 years ago.
No drugs, no nothing, no sex, no nothing, completely... like a retreat.
Yeah.
I put myself there.
On a lonely night, meditating by the fire, something happened that turned Franz's life in a whole new direction.
And all of a sudden, Aboriginal men about 2 meters tall, painted up, strong, healthy looking, come running straight for me. Ooh. So I opened my eyes up, right? And I looked at the sky. There's nothing there.
This spiritual experience marked the beginning of Franz's new life.
No footsteps, nothing. After that, I get dreams after dreams, and now I'm in a ceremony.
Not too long after this, Franz got to know Richard Hunter and other senior Gulara Bulu men, most notably Richard's grandfather, Paddy Rowe, the leader of the tribe. They could see in Franz a kindred spirit and shared with him their country's stories.
My name is Richard Hunter. Nice to meet you.
Richard is in his early 60s and whippet lean. He's quieter than his Dutch friend, but profound in his own way. He exudes calm. For 30 years, Richard Hunter has been one of the storytellers in this part of the Kimberley on the Lurujari trail walks hosted by the Gulara Bulu people. Here's one of their promotional videos.
Firstly, I would like to welcome everyone on behalf of my family.
These treks are more than camping out. Tourists learn about songlines and the importance of country and practical things like how to catch food. You can also see some of the world's best dinosaur footprints in the coastal rock.
First of all, there will be Dreamtime story, you know. I'll be telling many, I'm the storyteller anyway. There'll be a lot of stories.
The Lurujari Trail was the brainchild of Richard Hunter's grandfather, the late Paddy Rowe. Paddy, or PR as he's called by his own people, was not born in this saltwater country. He was a freshwater man, a Nigana man, like John and Anthony Watson. But like Richard and Julie, 60 years later, Paddy's relationship caused upheaval in his mob because he'd taken up with a promised woman. So, in 1931, he found himself and his pregnant young wife taken in by the elders of the saltwater Jabba Jabba people. During the 1930s, the tribes in these coastal parts were decimated by the impact of white colonisation. The elders of this area saw leadership in Paddy Rowe. They adopted him and taught him the songlines so he could be a custodian of the country when they were gone. Paddy went on to establish the Gulara Bulu community nearby, further up the coast towards Broome. It's an area which includes James Price Point. So although the Rowes weren't originally of the coastal area, they were given the knowledge of the country, and with that came a sense of ownership, despite not having a bloodline to that country. It was a job Paddy Rowe and his descendants were happy to do for decades.
My story, my Dreamtime story will be told further up the road. My Dreamtime story will tell us where the spirit come from.
There was a time when the Gullarabaloo and the Kimberley Land Council were on the same side. Paddy Rowe's grandson, the late Joseph Rowe, known as JR, was the first named claimant alongside a Jabba Jabba elder on a native title claim over an area of land that included James Price Point. The KLC supported this joint claim. The song cycles known to Paddy Rowe were also important in winning another big native title claim over Broome. But everything started to fall apart when the WA government and energy giant Woodside set their sights on James Price Point as the location for a massive gas hub.
We started with a bold idea and the drive to see it through. More than 60 years later, this spirit still guides us as we pioneer oil and gas discoveries for Australian and global customers. We persist until we prevail, securing resources.
Bill, I've been here from day one, mate.
You've been here way before.
24 years of my life, I studied my law.
I know that, right? And I respect that.
And this is my job.
I respect that.
That's Joe Rowe talking to a policeman near James Price Point at the height of the community angst over the gas proposal more than 7 years ago.
I'll dedicate this fight to my grandfather. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be here today. This whole country would have been gone. I don't want no violence in this campaign. I want a peaceful action. This will win this fight.
Enough is enough! Enough is enough!
So this is the respect you give me.
Joe Rowe's words and passion sound very similar to those we heard in episode 4 from John Watson.
But the police came.
The former KLC chairman.
All these Aboriginal people, what you see here, they stood on their own feet.
When he was talking about the 1978 Nookanbar dispute with an American oil company and the state government. Back then, John Watson and what became the KLC were trying to protect sacred sites from a resources company. This time, however, it was the KLC supporting the development. The decision was not made lightly, but the view was the gas plant would bring jobs and prosperity. So this meant Joseph Rowe and the Watsons were in opposing camps. The James Price Point dispute, which began around 2007, saw the WA government compulsorily acquire the land. However, Woodside ended up choosing an offshore solution instead.
Woodside Petroleum will ditch its commitment to processing the $45 billion Browse Basin LNG gas resource onshore in the Kimberley.
But the damage on the ground had already been done. The issue ripped the Kimberley apart, and the wounds have yet to heal.
There's big divisions. You never see in family fighting against each other.
We heard from Kimberley traditional owner Loretta Bin Omar in episode 1. She helped explain the concept of wrong skin relationships and told us flood time, the wet season, was when people went missing.
Flood time is when people disappear.
She reckons the way native title has worked out has caused a lot of problems.
You never seen before that you got to draw a line where each family's supposed to own that bit of country. Never before that been seen. Everybody shared and everybody was caring for each other.
The fight over James Price Point made national headlines. High-profile musicians John Butler and Missy Higgins.
The oil and the gas companies come and destroy this beautiful, beautiful land.
Joined former Greens leader Bob Brown and former Telstra director, businessman Jeff Cousins.
To process it there is just crazy.
In standing alongside the Rose. This provoked strong criticism from the KLC and the then WA Premier, Colin Barnett, as well as conservative media outlets.
Fly-in, fly-out activists. Whatever they've ever
done. James Price Point is a good example about Greens activists stopping these kinds of projects going ahead.
An overly simplistic storyline emerged. It had people portrayed as either tree-hugging, latte-sipping greenies or greedy, sell-out, capitalist bastards. The reality is more complex.
But I fight for my law and culture. And nobody's going to take that away from me. Thank you.
Joe Rowe and his Gullarabaloo people always claimed they weren't anti-gas. But they believed the country around James Price Point was so special, no amount of money could sway them. The gas project was sold as a way to improve the living standards of people in the Kimberley. But the Gullarabaloo mob made the point that the people there had a right to decent schools and hospitals, just like everyone else in Australia. And no one else had to sell off their land to get those things. Still, the money on the table would have been life-changing. Woodside and the government promised a package of $1.5 billion for the Kimberley over 30 years. Unemployment rates in the Kimberley are roughly double that of the rest of Western Australia. And of those without jobs, Indigenous Australians are way overrepresented. In the middle of all this was the Kimberley Land Council.
Well, I looked up his site. He's an investigative journalist, and his job is to dig up dirt, break big stories.
That voice belongs to one of the most talked about men in the Kimberley, Wayne Bergman, and he's talking about me. It doesn't take long for word to spread. Wayne knew 7 months ago that I was asking questions. So he called around asking people not to talk to me. Unfortunately for him, one of the people he called was already talking and recorded Wayne's request to shut me down. Wayne was chief executive of the Land Council during the James Price Point dispute. His job back then was one I wouldn't envy, especially when the state government pulled the trigger to compulsorily acquire the land. Here's how Wayne Bergman explained his role in a 2011 interview with the ABC.
People who don't support the project have, a lot of them have played the man and not the ball. And I really think that by doing that, they undermined really the bigger opportunities and the bigger picture, what the Land Council and a whole range of other Aboriginal people along the coast were trying to achieve.
When it became clear Joseph Rowe, the traditional owner who was spearheading the anti-gas protest, wouldn't cave in, the KLC had a problem. Being first name applicant on the native title claim over James Price Point meant Rowe could act as a roadblock. To get around this, legal action, supported by the KLC, was initiated. And within 2 years, Joseph Rowe and another traditional owner were replaced as the first name applicants. Installed in their place were three other people, including Anthony Watson. That's right, the current Land Council chairman and the son of John Watson. Anthony is a fellow Nigina man like his friend Wayne Bergman. He didn't know the songs of the James Price Point part of the country because he'd never lived there nor gone through law there. But he was able to be named as one of the first applicants on the claim because he could point to a Jabba Jabba bloodline. Joe Rowe's nephew, Daniel Rowe, a Gulara Baloo leader in waiting, is pretty sceptical about how this happened.
Yeah, and well, you know, if you've got connection, you know, if you attach to some big organisation and you've got connection to government, you can influence the way the game is played. But it's played, you know, by the wrong people that don't come from that country. And that's why they just refuse to have any association with them. Because of that, you know, bullying and impact and input they put in, which they really should be there as a representative body to look after the rights and interests, not to put their finger in the pie or get sliced out of it.
Wayne Watson, Richard Milgan's boyhood friend, also has problems with how the Land Council, so heavily influenced by his father and brother, is being run.
But they're here and to get what they want, you know, like push this mobile and grab that place, no? Grab that, kick everybody out, leave that traditional owner that owned that place, he got no right in it.
Wayne's talking about people losing rights on their land, and he thinks old people are especially vulnerable.
Because old people, they don't know how to read, they don't know how to write, and everybody get caught up on that area, especially older people. They get caught up all the time.
Anne Polina was also drawn into the James Price Point dispute.
Really interesting, because I was in Broome and somebody approached me and said, "Oh, Anne, would you like to run for the Greens?" And I didn't say yes and I didn't say no, and I came back and I talked to my elders and I said to them, "Oh, there's sounds like there's a big development happening at Wamadan, and people want me to run for the Greens. And they sort of looked at me as if I was a little bit crazy, and they looked at me and they said, don't you realise? I said, realise what? We are the Greenies. We are the dark Greenies. We're the first Greenies.
In the end, she ran for local government and became Deputy Broome Shire President. Anne says it was an eye-opener, particularly when it came to what was happening at James Price Point.
I learned a lot. I learned a lot about politics. I learned a lot about greed. It meant those people who were the custodians and the guardians of those that place have now become totally dispossessed.
Wayne Bergman is used to criticism, especially about the hotly contested accounts of the way the KLC ran a meeting with traditional owners to get authorisation to deal on James Price Point. A gifted boxer in his younger days in Derby, the square-jawed and softly spoken Wayne Bergman has never lost his counterpunch. Here he is again speaking to the ABC in 2011.
It would be shameful to see the wishes of the whole group being undermined by people's good intention about concerns about the environmental integrity of the Kimberley, the decision being undermined by them expressing their views about development.
Other powerful Kimberley voices don't see things the same way. Here's an actor reading a 2011 comment from former KLC director, Yawuru leader and current federal Labor senator Patrick Dodson on how the Land Council has changed over the years.
When the KLC was established, the people drove the agenda in those days, not the organisations or the individuals in them.
Wayne Bergman stepped down as KLC chief in 2011. He was worn out by the James Price Point dispute. The whole thing taught him Aboriginal people needed to be better equipped to have a remote chance of a fair fight when it came to dealing with governments and corporations. So between 2010 and 2014, Wayne Bergman established a suite of companies falling under the banner of Kimberley Regional Economic Development Enterprises. He's CEO and director of CRED, as it's commonly known.
I'm just going to flick to the back to my slide if I can get to it.
This is Wayne Bergman in 2015 presenting at a Native Title conference.
Just very, really quickly so you get some context. Why this rationale and why we've set up these group of companies to look after Aboriginal people in the Kimberley to get organised. Because we know that if you're not organised, you get ripped off, you get knocked over, and you don't get the best deal.
As one of the first Kimberley men to earn a law degree at university, Bergman set up CRED to play to his strengths. Today, CRED is a Native Title one-stop shop. It's empowered by the KLC to negotiate on behalf of traditional owners. It also conducts heritage surveys on country and provides legal advice.
Umbridge Brewery is a not-for-profit foundation. It owns CRED Enterprises.
Wayne Bergman's talking about how CRED's companies sit under two charitable trusts established by the KLC. They're owned by several traditional owner groups. It means less tax worries for CRED. When you look at who else was instrumental in setting up CRED, some familiar names appear.
Yeah, hi, I'm Anthony Watson. I'm the chair of CRED.
This is from a video on CRED's Facebook page. It's been taken down since this podcast series started.
And this is one of our new initiatives towards getting enterprise development going within the community. But I've learned from my dad and all of my family members.
This is where the conflict of interest concerns kick in. Wayne Bergman's friend and current Land Council chairman, Anthony Watson, was CRED's first chairman. Anthony Watson was also on the board of the charity, which owns all the shares in CRED. And although he finished up as Land Council CEO in 2011, Wayne Bergman still serves as a special advisor to the KLC board. So it's all pretty tight. This is how Wayne sees CRED's role.
It's a bit of a wraparound service. This group, we don't operate on any government funding. It's a business. Obviously, if you make a profit or a surplus, it goes back into running the business and supporting your members. Working in close partnership with the Land Council.
Walking in two worlds is one of Wayne Bergman's mantras. It's an ambition impossible to fault. It's about getting access to the modern economy to provide meaningful work and a lift in living standards while maintaining your cultural heritage. Wayne's an extreme example of someone walking in two worlds. On any given day, he could be seen entering the invite-only Qantas Chairman's Airport Lounge, a place where government ministers and CEOs of corporate giants mingle away from the public view. And on the next, he could be painted and barefoot, taking part in a Nigina ceremony in the Kimberley. Wayne says CRED will never forget its roots.
Our members are pretty much a part of a desert tradition. We all practice.
Here's Wayne Bergman again from 2015.
A traditional law and custom in that area, and we're all connected through that cultural block. So in terms of making staff and me accountable and all that, this is the block that I'm part of and responsible for.
In its 2011 annual report, the KLC explained the concept of CRED and how it existed to benefit all Kimberley people. It stated,
"The establishment of these ventures does not change the role or function of the KLC. The KLC will continue to carry out its core responsibilities in the areas of native title, land and sea management, and agreements."
But by the time of its next annual report, things had changed. A lot.
The KLC contracted CRED Enterprises to provide a range of services, including negotiations for commercial agreements with mining companies and conducting on-country heritage surveys. It's up to individual claim groups if they use the services of CRED Enterprises or not.
So this means that within 1 year, the KLC board, where Wayne Bergman is a special advisor, had outsourced the profitable parts of native title while still getting the same taxpayer funding for work it had outsourced.
CRED project management costs. CRED CEO, $450 per hour. CRED in-house counsel, $290 per hour.
Their costs from a CRED invoice to a resources company with a project in the Kimberley.
EHSIS manager operations and logistics, $350 per hour.
This is the first time CRED's rates have ever been made public.
Accommodation for CRED staff, $670 per half day.
$450 an hour, or $3,600 for an 8-hour day, makes Wayne Bergman one of the best paid men in the Kimberley. He's worked hard and he's smart, so good luck to him.
Travel allowance, $765.80.
A traditional owner asked to go out on a clearance survey to make sure nothing sacred will get disturbed gets about $500 for a day.
Administration fee, 15% of subtotal.
Resource companies privately say getting heritage agreements done in the Kimberley is three times as expensive as it is in the Pilbara, about 600 kilometres further south. The upshot is Wayne Bergman and CRED have enormous power over the fortunes of both Australian Stock Exchange listed companies and traditional owners who have next to nothing. CRED conducts negotiations. Another arm of CRED does the heritage surveying and employs anthropologists and traditional owners. No work can progress until heritage approval is granted. And yet another CRED arm, the law firm, stands ready to go to court. Some Kimberley locals, like Froggy Finger, reckon this setup has now made companies too scared to come to the Kimberley.
You know, you've got to jump through too many groups. I mean, that's been going on a long time. I'd like to see that all go again before I die.
Froggy's the white pastoralist we heard from in Episode 3 about the police looking for Luma elder Jimmy Nerima after Julie Buck's body turned up.
No one will invest. No one will do any exploration work here because they're all upfront costs. Like it's huge costs.
That's the sound of hundreds of pages of documents leaked to me on the KLC and CRED in the past year being put on a table. They contain some big revelations, and you can find news stories about this on the Age website. But here's the main takeouts. The documents show the KLC told one mob it wouldn't continue to help secure native title for them because its traditional owners didn't want to use Wayne Bergman to negotiate a commercial development on their behalf. But getting native title claims up is the main reason the KLC exists and why it gets about $20 million a year from the taxpayer. It's not a good look for the KLC to be using native title as a battering ram to force traditional owners in the direction of its former CEO when they don't want to. I also got leaked two highly confidential agreements with mining companies, showing Cred's effectiveness as a negotiator. They're good deals. The agreements include big upfront payments, royalties, shares and share options worth millions to traditional owners. But the contentious part is that Cred has played itself into these deals, and it stands to receive millions in benefits into its charitable trust. A common criticism is that this outcome dilutes the traditional owner's stake. There's also a Cred invoice given to one Kimberley Aboriginal community which requests $20,000 to organise a one-day meeting with other traditional owners. I'm told this invoice was rejected on the basis, and I quote, "Blackfellas don't pay to talk to other blackfellas." Then there's a bunch of emails and correspondence which show examples of what could be perceived as a sense of entitlement. One example has Cred trying to get $1,000 from a mining company to cover Anthony Watson's airfare and accommodation to Perth when he was already going to be in town on other business. Here's another example.
Thank you for taking the time to read this proposal. It is much appreciated. The Dreamtime Project uses fashion and modelling as a carrot to attract young Aboriginal women.
That's an actor reading a letter sent by Wayne Bergman's adult daughter to the bosses of some mining companies Cred was negotiating with on behalf of traditional owners.
We are currently seeking sponsorship to enable a group of 12 Aboriginal women from the Dreamtime Project to travel to New York and participate in a social and cultural exchange. The girls will also be using the knowledge that they have learned from workshops whilst participating in the New York fashion show.
I thought hard about whether to include this letter, as I don't like involving people's children, even if they're adults, in stories. But then I thought, how many other young people in the Kimberley would even be in a position to try such a thing on?
It is with this in mind I have identified your organisation, as I understand you operate in the Kimberley and may be interested in making a small contribution.
The companies in question didn't pay the $6,000 requested. The result of the KLC's outsourcing of so much work to Cred has created confusion and uncertainty. People like Loretta Bin Omar and Lisa Skinner see millions of dollars going in, but not much in the way of charity coming out. In fact, a petition with several hundred signatures was sent to the federal government recently to request Cred no longer act as their agent with mining companies.
I think that they should close KLC and do not fund them again, because who knows where the money is going and if they're fighting the right fight. I don't think so.
KLC, Uldo and those other Aboriginal corporations, they got to be honest with the people and they got to be fair. Because these people are signing their life away. For what? Well, they're getting big mention in the city or whatever. They got everything. Well, these people still standing still. They're stuck in the mud still. They're getting the credit, and these people who got the information and all that for country, they get nothing. Still empty hand.
Wayne Bergman declined to be interviewed for this podcast. He said in a statement Cred had provided more than 11,000 hours of pro bono work, created 41 full-time equivalent jobs, and contributed more than $24 million to the regional economy. You can see this full statement on the Wrong Skin website, as well as a shorter statement from the KLC. The Land Council strongly rejects claims in Episode 4 that it influences who gets included on a native title claim. It says that this process is totally driven by traditional owners. As for the claim that it's withholding genealogy reports, The KLC says it has legal advice saying it cannot release them while native title claims are pending court decisions. It says it's working to find a way to return them. Numbers can help tell a story. The financial reports of the Amburini Buru charity, which owns CRED, show nearly $20 million in revenue between 2014 and 2017. But when you take away salaries, traditional owner payments and other costs, CRED's main charitable outgoing is $57,000 for scholarships during that period of time. In other words, less than 0.5% of its revenue.
That's why I'm not involved with CRED, KLC or any other.
Wayne Watson, the outcast son who could have joined his father, John Watson, and brother, Anthony Watson, in effectively running the Kimberley, has chosen instead a transient life. He travels around in a busted-up red Land Cruiser, which he calls a bomb, to be close to people.
I'm happy with that bomb over there. Just move around. If they don't want me, I can move.
Wayne Watson sees it as his destiny to stand up to his own family and to challenge the status quo so that the ordinary people get more of a say.
And for my challenge is to go against them. And that for myself, like I want to stand up for everybody. You got to push them. You got to fight against them. We don't do it. Who else going to do it? The trouble going to keep continue to the next one. Generation, who's going to stand up? The last of the generation going to get nothing.
Back at the block north of Broome, where Richard Hunter and Franz Hoogland live alongside the Rowe family, there's been more upheaval. The federal court in 2018 rejected their native title claim over the land Paddy Rowe was made custodian of in the 1930s. Rival claims from three other groups, including Anthony Watson's Jabba Jabba mob, were granted native title because they could point to a bloodline connection to the land predating British arrival. The court decision was a severe blow to the Galara Baloo. But still, Franz and Richard have an optimistic long-term view and a quiet confidence that seems to be powered by their connection to country.
I mean, there must have been something smart about culture that it can continue. The system must be all right. But then again, everybody knew everybody. Everybody went to law. Everybody had a law, a real law. A law connected to every step you do. Connected to every tree, every insect, every fish. That's a different law than one on paper that tell you you were right or you were wrong. What were you doing there?
Yeah, I think the thing up all this native title fight we're having against each other, when all that over, everything will go quiet. And everybody will come back as one, then it'll be quiet again.
Next time on Wrong Skin.
Like if whoever knows about it, any information or last seen or what had happened, like just come forward, say the police.
You know, we know where Richard is. Everybody knows where Richard is.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review Wrong Skin on iTunes. And if you know more about this story, email Richard Baker, rbaker@fairfaxmedia.com.au. Wrong Skin is investigated and presented by Richard Baker and produced by Rachel Dexter and Tim Young. The executive producer is Greg Muller, Tom McKendrick is head of video and audio, and Dr. Siobhan McHugh is consulting producer.